Hello? Are you ready?
Yes.
Then we'll begin.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Spamalot, the Broadway musical based on the film Monty Python and the Holy Grail, has been nominated for 14 Tony Awards, including two nominations for Best Performance by a Leading Actor in a Musical for Tim Curry and Hank Azaria. On today's Fresh Air, we feature interviews with them both. The Tony Awards are Sunday night. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Cinderella Man. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Tim Curry became a star and was typecast for decades when he reprised his British stage role of sweet transvestite Frankenfurter in the 1975 cult film musical The Rocky Horror Picture Show. 30 years later, he's back on stage, this time on Broadway, in a role and play inspired by a film. The film is Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and the musical, Spamalot, is the big hit of the Broadway season and a frontrunner at Sunday's Tony Awards. Tim Curry isn't just in Spamalot, he's at its center as the grail-seeking King Arthur.
I am Arthur, king of the Britons, and we are seeking men who are able. And so we're recruiting Dennis to sit at our very, very, very round table. Ready!
Who's the king?
You are!
Who's the king?
You are! A-R-T-H-U-R-I-T-H-E!
Spamalot is written by Monty Python member Eric Idle and directed by Mike Nichols. In addition to Tim Curry, Spamalot features Hank Azaria, from whom we'll hear in the second half of the show, as well as David Hyde Pierce and Sarah Ramirez. Terry spoke to Tim Curry in March when Spamalot was about to open. She asked him how he got involved with the show.
I've known Eric Idle a long time, one of the original Pythons, and he now lives in Los Angeles, as do I. And so we see each other quite a bit. And in fact, the summer before last, we were hoping to do a film together, which he had written and was going to direct, which was a kind of demolition of every Miramax movie ever made, called The Remains of the Piano. And that never quite happened because the money... It's a good title, isn't
very
it?
Very good, very good.
I was going to play the Reverend Whoopsie. And Robin Williams was going to play Vanessa Redgrave in Howard's End. I loved his lines, which were stuff like, you, I haven't met you before. You shall have the teacup when I go. No, you shall have the grand piano. Oh, no. No, you shall have the house. So that never happened, but he said, I think it looks like we are finally going to get to do the musical version of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and we're going to call it Spamalot. And first of all, I thought that was just terribly funny. But I also thought, oh, well, you know, I'll believe it when it happens. And then suddenly Mike Nichols was directing it, and they put David Hyde Pierce and Hank Azaria and I and a couple of other people on a plane from California, and we came into New York and we sat down and read it with a bunch of other people from New York, some of whom are in the play. And it just went like gangbusters, and I guess the next day I was going to be King Arthur.
So Spamalot incorporates some classic Monty Python bits in it. That I assume a lot of people in the audience probably know by heart. What kind of response do you get when you get to the classic parts?
It's quite interesting because the audience always sort of contains some core of Monty Python fans who see stuff coming, you know, and react with great whoops of joy. And then settle down to see it unfold. I mean, they're hugely welcoming, and then they really want to see it happen. I mean, happily, they're not talking along with it, because that would, you know, that would need a spanking. But but they love it, and they see it coming, and they are thrilled to see characters and sketches that they recognize.
You knew the Monty Python material, and the audience knows a lot of the Monty Python material. But do you know a lot of the early Nichols and May sketches?
I do. I was always a fan, and so it was sort of very interesting for me to work with him. And he has a first of all, every note that you ever get from Mike is preceded by "That was wonderful." That was wonderful. One small thing. So you're given this enormous sort of sense of entitlement, and then something tiny and completely accurate is lodged like a little sort of Navajo arrow in your brain. And what his great note, I think, because I was playing it pretty broadly at the beginning, because so much of it is like something that we in England called pantomime and sort of is part of vaudeville, really. And his first note and recurring note to me is, yes, that's great. It's, you know, it's very funny. Now let's make it true. And I think that's his great gift to this material, is that he's given it a great big sort of beating Arthurian heart. And that's an extra dimension that you just sort of don't expect. And of course also makes it so much more interesting to play.
Tim Curry speaking with Terry Gross. Let's hear something else from the Broadway musical Spamalot. David Hyde Pierce from Frasier in his show-stopping second act number called You Won't Succeed on Broadway. The king is seeking his advice.
Have you heard of this Broadway?
Yes, sire. And we don't stand a chance there.
Why not?
Because Broadway is a very special place, filled with very special people. People who can sing and dance, often at the same time. They are a different people, a multi-talented people, a people who need people, and who are, in many ways, the luckiest people in the world. I'm sorry, sire. We don't have a chance.
But why?
Well, let me put it like this. In any great adventure, if you don't want to lose, victory depends upon the people that you choose. So listen, Arthur, darling, closely to this news. We won't succeed on Broadway if we don't have any Jews. You may have the finest sets, fill the stage with penthouse pets. You may have the loveliest costumes and best shoes. You may dance and you may sing, but I'm sorry, Arthur King, you'll hear no cheers, just lots and lots of boos. You may have butch men by the score, whom the audience adore. You may even have some animals from zoos. Though you've poles and krauts instead, you may have unleavened bread, but I tell you, you are dead if you don't have any Jews. They won't care if it's witty or everything looks pretty. They'll simply say it's shitty and refuse. Nobody will go, sir. If it's not kosher, then no show, sir. Even Goyim won't be dim enough to choose. Put on shows that make men stare with lots of girls in underwear. You may even have the finest of reviews.
You're doing great!
But the audiences won't care, sir, as long as you don't dare, sir, to open up on Broadway.
If we don't have any Jews.
Music from Spamalot, the Eric Idle musical starring David Hyde Pierce, Hank Azaria, and Tim Curry. More with Tim Curry after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening back to an interview Terry Gross recorded earlier this year with actor Tim Curry. Curry became famous for his starring role in the 1975 cult classic The Rocky Horror Picture Show as Dr. Franken Furter, the sweet transvestite from transsexual Transylvania. Here he is welcoming two naive strangers, Brad and Janet, played by Barry Bostwick and Susan Sarandon, to his isolated estate.
Magenta. Columbia. Go and assist Riff Raff. I will entertain...
Brad Majors?
This is my fiance, Janet Weiss.
Weiss?
Enchanté. Well, nice. And what charming underclothes you both have. But here, put these on. They'll make you feel less vulnerable. It's not often we receive visitors here, let alone offer them hospitality.
Hospitality? All we wanted to do was to use your telephone, damn it, a reasonable request, which you've chosen to ignore.
Yeah, don't be ungrateful.
Ungrateful?
How forceful you are, Brad. Such a perfect specimen of manhood. So dominant.
You know, like so many other of your fans, I first saw you in the Rocky Horror Picture Show in the 70s. And when you see somebody in a movie for the first time, it's sometimes hard to tell how good they are. You don't know, is this all they can do? Do they do other things too? Is this what they're really like? Or, you know, how much are they acting? And so I saw you, I guess it was probably like the late 80s, in Wise Guy, the TV series.
Yes.
And you played a kind of Phil Spector-ish, brilliant but crazy record producer.
That's right.
And a great, really terrific performance. And that's, as I think, is when I really got the picture. Wow, he's really good at doing all kinds of things. So.
That's so nice. I mean, it's sort of important for me because, you know, that first performance that sort of introduced me to everybody was so out there and so...
I'll say, yeah.
So kind of outrageous that, you know, I was a very quiet boy for a while, you know, just to make sure that people got it, that, you know, that wasn't necessarily who I was.
Was that because
it was my first movie, you know?
That was your first movie?
Yeah.
How did you get the part?
I got the part because I used to work a great deal at a theatre in London called the Royal Court. And I guess they have a little theatre upstairs which seats about 60 people, and I did Brecht there, and I did a sort of Rudyard Kipling show there. And I guess the next show, I did a dreadful musical, a Marxist musical called Give the Gaffers Time to Love You, with a director who kept saying, "Barry, the second act just simply isn't Marxist enough." And that, of course, never even opened to the critics. But the next show coming in was this other musical called The Rocky Horror Show. And originally I played Frankenfurter as though he was German. He was Dr. Frankenfurter, and everything was very interesting and stupid. And then one day I heard a woman on a bus saying, "Do you have a house in town or a house in the country?" And I thought, yes, she should sound like the Queen. So
that's
he
great.
Should sound like the Queen. So, but that's how it happened, and it just started in this tiny theater, you know, and it just took off like a sort of rocket.
Did you like the kind of cheap horror films that it in part parodied?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, it. Richard's brilliance really was just, you know. It was really like reaching up a hand into the zeitgeist and just grabbing, you know, horror, 50s horror movies, Sandra Dee, comic books, and 50s rock and roll, and just hurling them all together with the, you know, some fishnet tights thrown in. And the fishnet tights really, you know, came from a brilliant costume designer called Sue Blaine, who I'd worked with before, actually, in a wonderful theatre in Scotland called the Glasgow Citizens Theatre, where we did a production of The Maids, where I wore exactly that corset.
The Jean Genet play?
Yeah, the Jean Genet play. I played Solange, and we bought the corset for £3 off a barrow in the market in Glasgow and wore it back to front.
That's funny. You'd be wearing it in, for like this transgressive playwright Genet, and then this kind of parody
absolutely.
Of everything Rocky Horror.
Absolutely.
Well, there's probably nothing that can get you into character quickly, like black bikini briefs, fishnet stockings, the garter belt, the corset, the whole whole thing.
Well, absolutely. But that was a fairly late development. I mean, I had no idea it was going to be like that.
You until, didn't when you accepted the part?
No. I thought I'd be in a white lab coat, you know. And I mean, the great gag about, the way that we all looked was, and I've always said this to anybody who's ever asked me about playing Frankenfurter, if they were playing it, you know, to just never think about it as drag, because it's not. It's just what people wear in Transylvania. You know, it's just what everybody wears in Transylvania, so just get over it, you know. It's truck driver drag. It's not about going boop-boop-a-doob. It's just what they happen to wear.
I think the thing I found most amazing about the whole phenomenon of Rocky Horror was watching, like, the 12-year-olds outside the theater parading around in their transvestite clothes. Because they were all, it was like all these 12-year-olds outside the theater imitating you in your getup. And you had to just kind of ask yourself, what is going on here? What do the 12-year-olds make of it? I mean, are they going through some kind of gender thing, or do they just love the movie? Like, what is this about?
I think it's all of the above. It's a kind of rite of passage now, I think. And actually, first of all, it's a guaranteed weekend party to which you can go with or without a date and probably find one if you don't have one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, I think, a chance for people to try on a few roles for size, you mm-hmm. know, help them maybe figure out their own sexuality. I mean, I think that's probably taking it a little deeper than it needs to go, but I think it has had a useful purpose in that way, and I've certainly had some very interesting and moving mail from people who have said, you know, thanks for helping me figure out who I was, you know, and that's very nice.
Your father was a chaplain in the British Navy.
Yes.
What did your parents think of your role in Rocky Horror?
Well, he, alas, was dead, because he died when I was 12.
Oh.
So he wasn't even aware that I was an actor, even. I think my mother, who, you know, is really like one of those sort of Monty Python ladies, you know. I can't imagine what's going on. you know, who always had a hat. And since my first job in the theatre was Hair, and, you know,
and you were probably naked in that, right?
And I did appear naked in it. I think, you know, it was a relief to her that I actually was wearing clothes of any kind. In,
at least
in
you
the
were covered by a corset and garters.
She was happily unaware that that part of the character, particularly Frankenfurter at his most gracious, was based on her.
In what way?
Well, it was sort of her telephone voice, you know. Do you have any tattoos, Brad? my sister, when she saw it, fell on the floor and said, you know, does she know? And I said, no, she has absolutely no idea, and please don't tell her. She thought it was very, very amusing and brought all her friends. So she was pretty hip lady, my mother, and she got it. I mean, you know, astonishingly. She loved it.
That's really
she didn't
funny.
Like it as much as the Pirates of Penzance, which I did at Drury Lane. Because the Queen Mother came to that, and that, you know, was the total seal of approval of my career.
And I would bet that the Queen Mother did not go to Hair or Rocky Horror.
I don't think she went to either, although Princess Margaret did come to Rocky Horror and had a wonderful time.
Really?
And so did Princess Diana actually requested to meet me because she was such a Rocky Horror fan.
So did you ever meet Princess Diana?
I did actually meet Princess Diana. I was doing a production of Love for Love, and it was taken to Vienna for British Week, and we played at the Burgtheater, and Prince Charles and Princess Diana were the guests of honor, and which was when she said that she very much wanted to meet me, and so they sort of put me at the end of the receiving line, and Prince Charles said, I think I've seen you on television. Haven't I seen you on television? I said, yes, sir, I'm sure you've seen me on television. Yes, I thought I'd seen you on television. But Diana said, you were in the Rocky Horror Show. And I said, yes, Ma'am, I wasn't. I was, but I'm sure that you haven't seen it. She said, oh, yes, she said. It quite completed my education. She was a very funny girl. And a very beautiful one, and sort of a very wicked smile came with that sentence. She was great fun, the world is poorer without her.
Tim Curry speaking with Terry Gross. He's nominated for a Tony for his role as King Arthur in the Monty Python Broadway musical Spamalot. We'll hear more with Tim Curry in the second half of the show. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
How do you do? I see you've met my faithful handyman. He's just a little brought down because when you knocked, he thought you were the candyman. Don't get strung up by the way I look. Don't judge a book by its cover. I'm not much of a man by the light of day, but by night I'm one hell of a lover. I'm just a sweet transvestite from transsexual Transylvania. Let me show you around and maybe play you a sign. You look like you're both pretty groovy. Or if you want something visual that's not too abysmal, we could take in an old Steve Reeves movie.
I'm glad we caught you at home. Could we use your phone? We're both in a bit of a hurry.
Right.
We'll just say where we are, then go back to the car. We don't want to be any worry.
Well, you got caught with a flat wheel. How about that? Well, babies, don't you panic.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, Pontiff for a New Era. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Summer Guest, a novel of love, family secrets, and a dying man's last wish by Justin Cronin, author of Mary and O'Neill. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Tim Curry and hear from another star of Spamalot, Hank Azaria. Also, David Edelstein reviews Cinderella Man.
Hup! We're knights of the round table. We dance whenever we're able. We do routines and chorus scenes of footwork in bed cable. We dine well here in Camelot. We eat ham and jam and spend a lot. We're knights of the round table. Our shows are for mid-able. But many times we're given rhymes that aren't quite unsing-able. We're opera mad in Camelot. We sing from the diaphragm.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. Tim Curry became famous for his role in a cult classic, playing Dr. Frank Inferter in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Now, 30 years later, he's up for a Tony for his role in another, playing King Arthur in the Monty Python Broadway musical Spamalot. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Curry, recorded in March, just before Spamalot opened.
You grew up in England. Your father was a chaplain in the Navy.
Yeah.
Were you religious when you were growing up?
Rather not. As preacher's kids tend not to be, you know. I mean, my father was pretty chill about all of that. I mean, he wasn't... Methodism in England is a lot more relaxed than it is in the States. It's not as forbidding or as chilly. And he was a very liberal and very funny man. But, you know, I did willy-nilly show up, you know, to Sunday school morning and afternoon and went to hear him preach when he was on shore, because he was quite often at sea. And I spent my childhood in sort of various sort of naval bases until he died when I was quite young, when I was 12. And we moved to South London, and I went to boarding school. And I actually went to a school that was founded by John Wesley, I mean, who founded Methodism in, you know, the school, I think, started in 1784 or something, and was founded for the sons of Methodist ministers. So I went to a fairly kind of churchy school, which has also turned out to be very kind of relaxed and liberal, and I was a cheerful agnostic, really, you know, from then on.
Still a cheerful agnostic?
Still a cheerful agnostic.
Did you have to go to church, and did you sing a lot in church?
Well, that was the great bonus, because the Methodist Church has a remarkable body of hymns, largely a great number of them by Charles Wesley. And so I sang in church from about, I don't know, six or seven, and I was a real boy soprano for, you know, until my voice changed.
It changed a lot, didn't it?
It did change quite a whole lot. I was very lucky because I had a great music teacher who sent away to Westminster Choral School for exercises when my voice started breaking, because, you know, so often people with wonderful boys, soprano voices end up with no mature singing voices at all. And I managed to make that transition happily. And it's funny, when I was doing, I don't know whether this is interesting, when we were doing Pirates of Penzance, I had my first singing lessons, really. The lady who was doing them said, you know, we must work on your falsetto and get your range up. And I said, I don't have a falsetto. And she said, oh, nonsense, everyone has a falsetto. And I said, no, I really don't. And she made me find one, and she suddenly had this revelation one day, and she said, were you a boy soprano? And I said, yes, I was. And she said, you're in mourning for that sound, aren't you? And I realized that I was. I mean, it is a great sadness not to be able to make that extraordinary pure sound that you do make as a boy soprano.
That's actually really interesting, yeah.
It is. It's fascinating, isn't it? I think I just, you know, cut off that alley.
But you kept singing, didn't you?
I kept singing, yes, absolutely.
So did you go to, like, the loud, gruff rock band kind of singing afterwards?
Well, no, actually. I mean, you know, at 17 or 18, I was singing leader, and, you know, I was singing sort of classical music, really. But then, I guess, you know, the Beatles happened, and it was all over.
So what kind?
That and Marlboro, you know.
Marlboro cigarettes.
It's funny because I actually quit smoking a year ago, and it was fascinating because within 3 weeks, my voice went back up a tone and a half, and I remembered, and I heard the voice that I remembered myself singing in when I was 19 or 20.
Huh.
It's very odd, and it's a great warning to anyone to stay away from the demon tobacco, stupid drug that it is.
Now, I've read that you not only love Billie Holiday, but that you do Billie Holiday, and I wasn't sure whether that meant that you sing a lot of songs associated with her or whether you can do a good Billie Holiday impression.
Well, both, I hope. I don't know. I did a film for television in England called Blue Money, where I played an impressionist. And I did a few singers, including Billie Holiday. Who else did I do? I did Ray Charles, and I did Elvis, and I don't know. Yes, I do Billie Holiday. Whether you would want to hear it now, I sort of doubt.
Well, but you'd be wrong, because I'd love to hear it if you were game.
Them that's got shall give, them that's not shall lose. So them Bible says, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own. Oh, it's much too early in the morning for you.
Did her singing influence you a lot? Even though
it's, hugely. I didn't listen to anybody else for about 2 years when I was 18. I was just, you know, this awful, depressive teenager listening to Billie Holiday and wondering, you know, which gloomy Sunday I was going to throw myself under a car.
Oh, yeah. Which
you know how
which,
it is.
Which period were you mostly listening to of her?
Mostly the really early stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I find the later stuff very...
Because you were singing in the later voice.
Very unhappy.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the voice you were
doing.
Well,
I'm singing the later voice because, of course, I'm singing 8 times a week and
right.
I don't quite have the control over my voice that I do. Really, it doesn't actually sort of start to warm up until the evening. It's weird when you do a musical because you sing so hard and so regularly that your voice kind of goes into shock until it actually has to be produced for that evening.
Did you always know that you had that ability to mimic?
Yes, I think, you know, you have it or you don't. Hank Azaria, who's in this show, is an absolutely dazzling mimic and do anybody. You sort of have an ear or you don't, I think. And I think, you know, a lot of it has to do with amusing other children when you're young and, you know, getting out of being hit.
Right. Is that effective for you?
I think it's effective for all childhood comedians. I think it's, you know, the root of a great deal of comedy.
Well, Tim Curry, I wish you really good luck with Spamalot. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much indeed. My pleasure.
Tim Curry, speaking with Terry Gross in March. He's nominated for a Tony for Best Performance by a Leading Actor in a Musical for his role in Spamalot. The ceremony is Sunday night. Coming up... We'll hear an interview with Hank Azaria, now starring as Sir Lancelot, among other roles, in Monty Python's Spamalot. This is Fresh Air. We just heard from Tim Curry, who's up for a Tony as Best Actor in a Musical for his role in Spamalot. He'll face tough competition from Hank Azaria, who's up for Best Actor in a Musical for his role in Spamalot. They account for 2 of Spamalot's 14 Tony nominations. Azaria has 4 roles in Spamalot, including Sir Lancelot and Tim the Enchanter. He's no stranger to playing multiple parts. On The Simpsons, he does the voices of Moe the Bartender, Chief Wiggum, Apu, and more. He's also been seen on the big screen, including roles in Shattered Glass, Dodgeball, Mystery Men, and The Birdcage. Terry Gross spoke with Azaria late last year.
How did you get to be on The Simpsons? And 2 of the voices you do are Moe, the bartender, and Apu, who runs the convenience store, the Quickie Mart.
Yes, that's correct. Moe was the first voice I did. There's little Moe for you there. And Apu was actually the third voice, I believe, that I did. And I was 22 years old. This was a long time ago. I'm 40 now. I was 22 years old and I hadn't worked much. There was an original voice of Moe the bartender that I guess they weren't too happy with. wanted to replace. And I had done one other voiceover at the time for a failed Fox kind of Roger Rabbit-type pilot where I played the voice of this animated dog. And I guess they'd known me from that, so they called me. It was just kind of like not an open call, but there was a lot of people there. And I went in. There was Matt Groening and a guy named Sam Simon who created the show. And I did this voice, and I was doing the play at the time in L.A. where I was playing a drug dealer, and I was sort of doing a bad Al Pacino impression in the play from Dog Day Afternoon. I was sort of talking like this, like kind of Al kind of sounded in Dog Day Afternoon. And I said, what about that voice? They're like, well, we want Mo to be gravelly. So I just made that voice gravelly, and it sounded like that. And they were just like, listen, that's great. Can you come record that right now? Literally on the spot. And I was like, yeah, sure. And I walked over with them on the Fox lot and recorded it. I had no idea. I hadn't read a script. I just recorded these lines that they needed and left, and frankly thought that was the last I'd hear of it. And they kept calling me back week after week. The next week I did Wiggum. Chief Wiggum, chief of police, talks like this. And then I did Apu. And then after about midway through the second season, they made me they gave me a contract. They made me a regular. By that point, I was doing like 5 or 10 voices.
Did you know you could do voices? I know you did that voice on that animated series that you mentioned. But had you done a lot of work like that before?
No, I hadn't done work like that before. But I'd certainly, my friends refer to me as the freakish mimic.
And I, what does that mean?
It means I can mimic a lot of people's voices almost exactly right away, and it is a little bit freakish. And I've always been able to do it. And since I was a child, you know, to the point where I thought everybody, you know, when you're 5, you think everybody can do it. You don't realize it's a special talent. And it's just fortunate for me that I found, you know, the ultimate great outlet for that particular weird skill, which is like a job like The Simpsons, where I must have done like 50 voices on that show by now in the 16 years we've been doing it.
How did you come up with the voice of Apu? And he's an Indian in America who runs the Quickie Mart.
Correct. He really is just an Indian guy. I mean, in Los Angeles, pretty much every 7-Eleven or convenience store worker is either Indian or Pakistani or from this area. And when I first moved to L.A., these were the people I really interacted with mostly because I didn't know anybody. So I would talk to these guys. He's also kind of loosely based on Peter Sellers' character from the film The Party. I don't know if you know that, but Peter Sellers in that movie plays a character named Hrundi V. Bakshi. And he's a very open, sweet, kind, innocent guy. So sort of Apu's personality is kind of based on that character.
You've had to sing as Apu?
I have had to sing as Apu, it's true.
Is it hard to sing in character?
It's much easier for me to sing in character. It's much more difficult for me to sing in my own voice. It's much easier for me to sing as Wiggum or as Apu or even as Mo.
Why is that?
I think I'm just more comfortable with you know, the mask, you know, and the vocal mask. You know, Chief Wiggum's like this. It's sort of easier to sing like this than it is to sing. I'm not embarrassed to do that, but I'd be embarrassed to do the same thing in my own singing voice. It's weird.
Is it any easier to do voices when you're doing it just as the soundtrack for animation? Is it harder to do it when your body's there and your body doesn't necessarily fit the voice?
No, yes and no, I guess. I find that, you know, because I'm so vocally oriented that whenever I have to do a role in a movie or on TV that does have a very thick accent or some strange vocal quality, the body tends to follow naturally from the voice you get. You know, when I did The Birdcage and I played a guy, a Guatemalan gay guy who talked like this, your body tends to follow the way that voice is. It's hard to, like, carry yourself in a very macho way when you're speaking like that.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you played the Guatemalan housemaid in The Birdcage. And who did you base the character on?
That was, I just, on the one hand, just tried to get a Guatemalan accent as authentically as I could, and then sort of find a way to be as feminine as I could. And I sort of had it narrowed down to 2 voices, one that was a little tougher than that. And then I sort of presented the voice to a friend of mine who is actually a very beautiful drag queen in L.A., And he sort of selected the more fruity voice. He said, you know, I wanted to make sure it was authentic. I wanted to make sure it wasn't too over the top. And he said that I should go with that one. And then I realized, though, after about 2-3 weeks of working on it, that it really kind of sounded exactly like my grandmother, which sort of, it really did. My grandmother's this, she's passed away, but I'm Sephardic Jewish, which is Spanish Jews. And she had this, she spoke this Spanish dialect, you know. And she was very sweet and loving and talked kind of like this. And it sort of realizing that it sounded like her also gave me a good piece of the character because she was so maternal and mothering and loving that it was very, if I sort of had her mentality, it was easy to be kind of feminine, thinking that I was just kind of my grandma.
Can you tell us something about your childhood, where you grew up, what your parents did for a living when you were young?
I grew up in Forest Hills, New York, in Queens.
Mm-hmm.
My father is retired now, but he worked in the garment center. He had a couple of, at different times, he had different dress manufacturing businesses. And my mother was a housewife, and raised three kids, me and two sisters. I have two older sisters. My mother really, they both loved show business, my parents, even though they weren't in it. They're tremendous aficionados of theater and opera and film and TV. They love everything. And they exposed me to a lot growing up, which I guess gave me some of the bug to do it. My mother actually was a publicist at Columbia Pictures in New York for a couple of years before she married my father. She's bilingual. She speaks Spanish. So she worked for their Latin country foreign distribution. She worked for publicity with South America and all the Spanish-speaking countries. And she loved it. And, you know, so I grew up really, we were always very, very aware of favorite actors and favorite movies and TV shows. And to this day, they see every film that comes out. They live in Miami now, you know, but they must see 3-4 films a week. And they know every television show.
So what was your first real break acting?
You know, I've had so many little breaks. I've had such a gradual career. I've skipped no steps. I mean,
how about commercials? Did you skip that step?
No, not at all. My first job was a commercial when I was 17 years old. The first audition I ever went on, I got. It was a commercial for like Italian television. Once I got The Simpsons fairly steadily, I stopped going out on commercial auditions, which seemed crazy at the time because they needed the money, but I was making just enough from The Simpsons to live, and I found it so demoralizing. I just couldn't deal with it anymore. I used to always sound sarcastic when I read commercial copy. I'd be like, listen, this product's really great. And they'd be like, can you say that again? You sounded sarcastic. I was like, yeah, I can't seem to help it.
Right.
I remember one day they were doing some ad campaign for Jell-O where they had this computer-generated animated character called Jell-O Man that was some gelatin O that lived in your refrigerator.
Uh-huh.
And they were looking for the voice of Jell-O Man. And I, you know, I'm reading this thing. I'm like, well, he seems like a vagrant. I mean, he's living in your refrigerator. So I did some kind of voice like this or something. Like, hey, I'm Jell-O Man. I'm here in your fridge. And this woman, I did, you know, the take. And this woman went, you know, we do want Jell-O Man to have a bit of an edge. But the children should also like him. He's likable. He's likable. He's relatable. So, you know, do it again. And, you know, Jell-O Man's nice. He's a nice guy. You want him there. And I was listening to this direction, and I realized this was going to be the last moment of my commercial voiceover career. I really did. I realized I can't take it anymore. And I just said to this woman, you know that Jell-O Man's not real, don't you? And I left. And that was it for me.
Oh.
Hank Azaria speaking with Terry Gross. He's up for a Tony for his role in the Monty Python Broadway musical Spamalot. The Tony Awards are televised live this Sunday.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life.
Coming up, David Edelstein reviews Cinderella Man. This is Fresh Air. The fighter James J. Braddock had a promising career in the 1920s, but broke his dominant hand in three places and wound up on relief during the Depression. The story of his fall and his amazing comeback in the mid-1930s is the subject of Cinderella Man, which reunites director Ron Howard with the star of A Beautiful Mind, Russell Crowe. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Yikes, I can't believe I fell for the schmaltzy Cinderella Man. It helps that it's schmaltz with a vein of foie gras. It's directed by Ron Howard and co-written by Akiva Goldsman, the team that brought us A Beautiful Mind. That movie distorted the facts of its subject's life, with tidy borders between fantasy and reality and a recurring cast of imaginary friends. But it was structured so ingeniously, and Russell Crowe was so real, that it would have taken a stronger guy than me to keep the tears from welling up. Cinderella Man is even more manipulative. It's a three-hanky weeper. You need two for your eyes and one to stanch your sympathetic nosebleed. It's the story of the lovable hangdog boxer and family man Jim Braddock and his mousy but rock-hard-when-it-matters wife May. As in life, his family goes from comfort in the 20s, when Braddock is winning, to near bottom at the peak of the Depression. Braddock is washed up as a fighter. He can't get even day labor jobs. His kids are sick, and then their electricity gets turned off. Down, down, down. It's laid on so thick it should be laughed off the screen. But Crowe is such a riveting actor. His physique and posture and rhythms are different every time. His Braddock is tender, with a lopsided grin, appraising eyes, and a head with a slight bobble from dodging punches maybe, but also suggestive of a haymaker's jig. The way he stylizes the performance lightens the bathos. May, played by Renee Zellweger, is frightened by Braddock's fighting. She thinks, along with a lot of other people, that the blowhard heavyweight champ Max Baer will kill him in the ring in the title bout, as Baer killed two other opponents.
It's not that I'm not grateful or proud. I am. I'm so proud of you. But we got off easy when you broke that hand. We're back to even now.
Right. And 9 months from now, we're back in the same boat.
Baby, please. We just don't have anything left to risk.
May. There's still some juice in these legs, and I can still take a few. Baby, please. Just let me take him in the ring. At least I know who's hitting me.
Zellweger isn't as imaginative as Crowe. She has that twittery voice, a prim mouth, and eyes so squinched they almost vanish into her dumpling cheeks. But I bought her love and dread. She's not a knockout, but she wins on points. As Braddock's manager, Joe Gould, Paul Giamatti is a knockout, with a wonderful, fast attack that lets him weave in and out of Crowe's more delicate cadences. It's a great matchup, and both actors triumph. This Depression-era fable has the plush design that only an A-list cast and director can justify. But once you get past the lack of grit in Howard's technique and all the zillion-dollar antique cars, you're swept along by the emotions. Cinderella Man brings home the scariness of the Depression. You see the day laborers begging for work and feel the constant nagging fear, not what FDR called fear itself, but the literal shortage of milk for the kids. After his miracle comeback, and by the way, Cinderella Man was a moniker actually bestowed on him by Damon Runyon, Braddock tells reporters, "I'm fighting for milk." That's a man acting on an instinct more primal than the one to clobber others. The movie has a weird anti-welfare tinge, though. The real Braddock was ashamed of accepting charity, and the movie seems to endorse his view. Desperate to reclaim his kids from better-off relatives, Braddock lines up for government relief, and the woman at the window looks sickened and says, "I never thought I'd see you here, Jim." Why does she feel contempt for the people she gives aid to in the middle of the Great Depression? Braddock's communist organizer friend is a doomed figure, while Braddock regards any attempt to change the system as, quote, punching stuff you can't see. He's not passive in the ring, though, and the fights clinch the movie. They're spectacular. No, they're not Raging Bull. They're less fancy and more emotional. You see them from Braddock's point of view, with white flashes of pain, and you cringe for his safety. He seems so breakable that when he comes up with the punches that flatten his opponents, you're stunned, even if you already know his story. At clobbering an audience, Ron Howard is peerless. And yet his clobbering feels wholesome, just like good dad Braddock's. Howard could be directing for milk.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers are Audrey Bentham and Julian Herzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation with a mandate from Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Dr. Sandra Horning and David Johnson are oncologists who are the current and former president, respectively, of the Society of Clinical Oncology. They are also cancer survivors. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with them about their diagnosis, treatment, and recovery, and how having cancer has affected their work. Join us for the next Fresh Air.